Jeff Sullivan is on Twitter at @based_ball. The senior editor at Fangraphs joins the Bernstein and McKnight show as he does at this time each week. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
So my instinct usually when something is going badly for a certain area player is to look at peripheral numbers and say, you know what, he's probably fine. And I looked at Jose Quintana's numbers and I can't say that. What's going on with him?
I was actually just looking at Jose Quintana, sort of anticipating this. And, you know, Quintana's always leaned on his fastball. And I can tell you, there's something else that's particular, I would say, to this radio broadcast. The two worst teams in baseball right now in pitch framing. I don't know if I need to explain pitch framing, but they happen to be the White Sox and the Cubs. These are teams that have not been able to be so successful around the edges. And I think not so much of a surprise. You look at the White Sox, and they haven't had necessarily great pitch framers for a while. They're an up-and-coming ball club. But the Cubs, you look at Wilson Contreras, he's got a lot of strengths, and he's got a few weaknesses. I mean, he's not a smooth receiver, I would say. So I don't want to make too much of this necessarily, but you figure Jose Quintana is a guy who thrives on working around the edges. He's certainly not a blow-you-away kind of pitcher. And you look at a game like yesterday, and it's home run trouble that got him, and he's a guy who historically hasn't allowed that many home runs. When the wind gets it, then, you know, what's going to happen. But this year, he has been less successful. I think his out-of-zone chase rate, so hitters have swung at pitches out of the zone against him far less often than they did just last year. His stuff looks basically the same. He's missing bats about as much as he always has, but he just hasn't been so successful around the fringes. I don't think that's all on the Cubs catchers, but it's probably a factor here. It's probably about more than just Jose Quintana alone.
Well, I was going to say, Jeff, I mean, he's pitched before and pitched really well in the American League with a designated hitter and on a team that was expected to succeed at different points in his White Sox career and still had bad pitch framing. What is the adjustment he can make to overcome missing those corners or not getting those calls on those corners? Is it, I mean, if he has to find more of the zone, don't we run into more contact?
It looks like he's been trying to use he's got a couple fastballs and he's going between his two-seamer and his four-seamer. A lot of pitchers do this, and he's been throwing a good number more four-seamers this year. I wonder if part of that is just that maybe his four-seamer isn't as advanced as his two-seamer is. Maybe he's trying to throw it up in the zone more often. And, you know, on a windy day in Chicago, that's not going to work very well for him. So I think that this is one of those things where there's probably not as much wrong with him as the numbers would suggest. He's not a walk a batter every two innings kind of pitcher. His command is better than that, should be better than that. I think he's not really that far away, but he's the kind of pitcher where when he makes the adjustment that he needs to make, because he's gone through stretches of having this home run trouble before. It's his fastball that's been abused the most, but when he makes the adjustment to get back to being Jose Quintana, I think it's the kind of thing that you're going to watch a game and think, was that so different? I didn't really see it, because for him, it's really a matter of about an inch and a half.
When you look at pitching in that way, is there a way you can measure framing-reliant pitchers and say that this guy needs more help, or this guy has got a higher range of benefit from framing than others, depending on where they live in the strike zone and where their little personal heat map is?
Yeah, I think you can look for the pitchers who live around the edges of the zone the most. You know, coincidentally, someone like John Lester. I mean, John Lester and David Ross back in the day had maybe the most symbiotic relationship of any catcher-pitcher framing relationship of the past, I don't know, 10 years. When we had data for that, it was through the roof. Ross was saving Lester like 10 runs a year. Anyway, you look for a guy who's thriving around the edges, not really obviously a swing-and-miss pitcher isn't going to care about framing very much. If you're, I don't know, take Zach Godley. He's a pitcher for the Diamondbacks. His whole thing is that he throws unhittable curveballs that are about a foot below the plate. He doesn't care about pitch framing that much. That's not what he is. If you have a guy like Yu Darvish, throws stuff that's so hard and moves so much, he's almost impossible to frame very well to begin with. You just can't expect it. Someone like Shohei Ohtani is going to be really hard to frame. So you're looking for the sort of the fastball and cutter heavy pitchers who don't have really high velocity, who you know are just supposed to pitch around the edges and get a lot of called third strikes. Guys like Jose Quintana and guys like John Lester. Lester, of course, has been very successful with this before in Chicago, and Quintana is trying to make it with a different catcher.
Jeff Sullivan of Fangraphs joining the Bernstein and McKnight show here on a Tuesday morning, as he always does. Joe Maddon's going to join the show a little bit later on, Jeff, and he's already talked after yesterday's game about the short starts and how much that's getting into the Cubs' bullpen and how many arms are being taxed at this point. What do we know about how long bullpens can last at the rate the Cubs have lasted, at the rate that burnout can run through guys like this? I know bullpenning is a fun new word, but we're not there yet with how this Cubs roster is constructed.
I know there was concern early, I think it was last year, that the Mets had about three good relievers, and they were throwing them out there, it seemed like, almost every other day. And one of the most difficult things when you are a fan is that when you're watching a game in April or May, and let's say your manager doesn't bring in the right or maybe the best reliever for a given inning, and then the backup reliever blows game or gives up the lead, as a fan, you're going to think that's inexcusable because you're never really thinking about preservation. But like you're getting at, the bullpen has to survive for six, realistically, if you're the Cubs, 7 months of the season. So you have to be really conservative with who you're using. And that does require longer starts. Now, when you have a guy like Tyler Chatwood, he's not really a long start kind of guy. You have a guy like Jose Quintana, who right now, when he's in walk and home run trouble, he's not a long start guy. Yu Darvish, of course, has not yet been that long start guy. And I think coming into the year, when you looked at the Cubs, if there was one real concern, it's that they didn't have the deepest bullpen, because you look around and there are a lot of teams who are going to be going through 10 to 12 to even 15 relievers on a somewhat regular basis, sort of that taxi squad idea. I don't think the Cubs pitching has gone that deep. It's really good at the top, but you know, how much of this is going to come down to, will they ever get a reliable version of Justin Wilson? Is that going to happen? It seems like they are probably going to need to make some sort of bullpen addition, because it is going to be difficult. They're in a dogfight. There are four pretty good teams in this division, which means they can't really take too many days off. You can't expect that many innings from some of the starters in the rotation. So they're going to have to get deeper in the bullpen, because they are going to be taxed, and I think that's a really hard thing to avoid.
So, Jeff, on the south side, the rebuild continues, and we talked Friday with Matt Davidson of the White Sox, and he was featured in a piece you wrote about some of the most changed hitters in baseball from last year to this year. Davidson's got a 974 OPS, a 164 OPS plus. He is 27 years old and hitting for a boatload of power. Do the White Sox start to change the calculus on who they keep around? Is Matt Davidson a guy that you, based on the changes that you've seen, a cornerstone now of what they can do in the future?
I was just looking at Davidson, thinking that I think he's deserving of a follow up. So at 27 years old, he's been in the major league. Obviously, he played most of a full season last year. But the absolutely incredible thing about Matt Davidson is, again, I'm going back to chase rate. It's not great radio, but it is what it is. Last year, Matt Davidson swung at a third of the pitches he saw out of the strike zone. A third of the pitches. That's not extreme. That's not Javier Baez territory, but that's high. That's higher than league average. He's cut that down by a third. He's now swinging at one out of every five pitches out of the strike zone. And that's just something we've more or less never seen, certainly not full season to full season. So it's an extreme amount of discipline. He's still swinging at strikes to the same amount that he did last year. It's just like overnight, Matt Davidson learned, if you don't swing at the bad pitches, then you get more of the good pitches and you draw walks. It's not a coincidence. His walk rate has like tripled or quadrupled. He's striking out a lot less. Power has never been a problem. He's been extremely powerful all along. I think at 27 years old, you wonder how long his career is going to go. But we have a number of these sort of late bloomers, not just Justin Turner, but the Mariners have Mitch Haniger, who's broken out at 27 mm-hmm. years old. These people are around. So I think if you're the White Sox, you figure Davidson is here. He's really good now. And if he keeps this up over a full season, he's not only going to be really desirable in the offseason, but he's a guy that you bat fourth or fifth in the lineup. Takes a lot of pressure off Jose Abreu if he's still around. So, yeah, I think over the offseason, I thought Davidson was maybe the worst regular designated hitter in the American League. I thought the White Sox were going to work to replace him. I half expected them to end up with Matt Kemp of all people, and here we are. And Matt Davidson looks like he's a really good hitter now, just all of a sudden. And I don't know. You were talking to him. What did he do? How did he learn his play discipline?
Well, he talked with Paul Konerko a lot in the offseason, actually, and it was a conversation that he really enjoyed, a lengthy one to be sure. But he was pretty impressed by the launch angle that had come down. I think in your piece, you wrote that the launch angle and come down, and Matt's not a real huge, you know, numbers dude, but he heard that, perked up a bunch. And what he said was, oh, that's more doubles. That's more base hits. That's more of what he needs, because he's always been able to get the walks or the strikeouts or the home runs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that when I have when I've looked at his sort of swing path as much as you can from the outside, he is hitting the ball in the air less. But, you know, there are the towering fly ball guys. You think when you hear about a guy who's hitting the ball in the air less, you think, oh, he's a ground ball machine. But take someone like Giancarlo Stanton, someone like Nelson Cruz. These are not guys who try to hit towering fly balls. Their home runs are line drives because they're trying to hit the ball back up the middle, just a little above the horizontal, if you want to put it that way. And I think that Matt Davidson has aimed lower, so he's hitting fewer fly balls and he's hitting more line drives, which for Matt Davidson, it probably does make him less exploitable in different areas of the strike zone.
We've had a theme that's been recurring when it comes to the Cubs in these meetings against the White Sox and playing against the Marlins, where some Cub fans are dismayed with the percentage of the runs that they score against the bottom feeders of baseball. And in the research that we did, just some shallowly done stuff, everybody does that, and good teams do that. Good teams beat bad teams. They run up numbers against bad teams. Good players pad their stats, for lack of a better term, against bad teams. But when do you find that it matters? When do you find that you get some predictive nature to this to say, look, when the playoffs start and they start going up against a team that's setting up its pitching staff, that's going to be using all high-leverage guys, that maybe these aren't going to be the same players in those matchups? When do we actually suss things out from playing against good and playing against bad?
Yeah, so it's not real easy to research this. There's a website called Baseball Reference. Everyone should be familiar with Baseball Reference, and they do split things out. You can look at how a team has done against teams who are better than 500 and teams who are worse than 500. That's about the extent of it, and I've looked at this before. I've looked for teams who have the greatest difference in one direction. I've looked for teams who have the greatest difference in the other direction, and it just hasn't been predictive that at all. You look at recent versions of the Washington Nationals, and now granted they have struggled to make it out of their playoff rounds, but they've beaten up on bad teams in the NL East for years, for as long as they've been a good baseball team, and they've still been strong. I think you look at the Nationals, that's not a team that's just a byproduct of beating up on teams like the bad Phillies or the Marlins or the bad version of the Mets. I know every single team does do it. And then on the other hand, if you have your team that gets shut down by some unknown number five on a bad team, you think, oh, that's so Cubs or that's so White Sox, depending on what you're talking about. But that happens to everyone too. Those are just the games that stick out in your memory because you think that should never happen. So I think the greatest concern is basically strikeouts. If you have a team that is strikeout prone, then it's going to be exacerbated when you get to the playoff time and everyone's throwing 95, everyone has sharp stuff, and you're not just going up there against the, I don't know, Brandon Finnegan's and Sal Romano's, because they're not going to see the playoffs. You're going to be looking at power stuff. So if you have a really strikeout heavy lineup, that is the only kind of lineup that can really be exploited in playoff time. But otherwise, I wouldn't be too concerned. Every team is beating up on the bad teams, and if you're not, you're probably a bad team yourself.
Like the Dodgers, maybe, because everyone saw that coming.
Yep.
Thanks, Jeff.
Absolutely.
That is Jeff Sullivan of FanGraphs.
I think he had thoughts on the Dodgers at the end there, and I stopped him. Yes. It's too bad. We're not talking about the Dodgers right now. They're terrible.
He shut down his Dodgers thoughts.
We're going to have to pick up with Jeff about the Dodgers next Tuesday.
When we come back, can we just reset real quick on what the Bulls' actual odds are for tonight, if we're talking about odds and chances? Because if you might need a...
Do you want to bet it? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm not saying I want to bet it, but hey, it's come through before.
It certainly has.
Well, that way, it means it's not due to come through again.
No, it's going to come through. They got the hot hand.
Gambler's fallacy. And well, and look, they believe in it. All these with their lucky charms. They're all there with the lucky pennies or the lucky this or the rabbit's foot.
Lil penny.
Or whatever they've got.
It's Lil penny.
With them as some sort of trinkets. And so
a talisman that automatically grants you the top five pick of the draft.
They will be doing it. So let's a little primer on what's at stake for the Bulls tonight that is now
talismans.
Now completely out of their control. They just didn't lose enough games.
No.
It was in their control, and they won too many games.
3 out of 4 or whatever it was.
Yeah, and they had 7 in a row at one point.
Yeah, that was bad.
That didn't work out well.
But you got the 22nd pick for those 7 in a row.
Yeah, well, we shall see. Let's again get just a refresher on what's happening tonight for the Bulls on The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This segment brought to you by Fogarty Schoen. Celebrate dad, your grad, or those closest to you with the fresh flavors of weekend Brazilian brunch now at Fogarty Schoen in Chicago, Rosemont, and Naperville. So Rick Camp has been running draft lottery simulations.
Rick's mad at me.
He said it only took 7 tries to net the Bulls the number 1 overall pick.
Right. Is that good?
I was very happy for Rick in doing that. And then I pointed out that if he did it 93 more times, he would only get 4 more Bulls positives.
Right. It just happened to come up early in your sampling there is all it is. Now, this is the paragraph that you need to know from Casey Johnson's Trib story here. The Bulls own a 5.3% chance at the number 1 pick. They have a 6% chance of the number 2 pick, a 7% chance of number 3, and a 44% chance of staying in their pre-lottery slot of number 6. If they drop, there's a 33% chance it will be to number 7, a 4.5% chance for number 8, and a 0.1% chance for number 9. So that's pretty much it. They are very likely to stay where they are, but this is sort of like what happened with the Derrick Rose year. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it just happens.
I was asked a little while ago whether or not those numbers feel good enough for the season they put you through.
No.
No, they don't.
They don't.
No, they really, really don't.
I know that we watched basketball that was not offensive. That we saw, and I said it throughout the year, they were a bad team that still looked to be well coached.
Yeah, they punched a little bit.
They knew what they were doing. What they were doing made sense. There was a method to some of it, but it was a little too good. And that's only okay if they draft exactly the right person this year and or sign LeBron.
Yes,
right?
Also that would be fine.
Or if that advanced development, that acceleration of their development means they're going to get better faster. But in this league, that's all incremental. You don't know if it's enough to matter.
I heard Joe Cowley on with the Molly and Hanley show this morning, and they talked kicking around the idea of the Bulls trading up a little bit, you know, moving up from that 6. They do have the 22nd pick in the first round as well, and I don't know what that means to you, I don't really know, but that's what you got for Nico Mirotic. And I Joe kind of mentioned that moving up a spot or two, possible, maybe. But you're not getting into that top 3 situation. If the draft plays out, if the lottery plays out tonight the way that it seems the numbers are playing out, that the Bulls stay around that 6 spot.
Right. It's like going to be Ayton, it's going to be Doncic, and it's going to be Bagley.
Bagley the 3rd, right?
Right.
That's it.
And then you start thinking about upside or...
Thinking about medicals.
With
the kid from Missouri. Yeah, and the Porter from Missouri. I mean, you start thinking about... You kick around those ideas, and if that's what you're left with... And I don't know if necessarily it's because of this draft that 5.3% for the number 1 overall pick feels less than what you should have after a season like that. Maybe it is because this draft is a little bit soft. But for me, if you start hoping on medicals at 6, if you start to think, oh man, maybe you get a dark horse here that really fits and, you know, something to grow on. That wasn't enough for the season you put them through.
No, or you start thinking high upside in somebody like Mo Bamba, who's just raw materials.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
The other aspect of this year's draft class is the bar has been raised by this year's rookie crop. You start looking around playoff performances and what rookies are doing now for teams. When you had a guy like Donovan Mitchell, who was
terrific.
The best player on a playoff team as a rookie.
It's terrific.
The stuff that Jason Tatum has been doing. There are guys who are playing and who matter, and it says, well, welcome to the NBA, son. No, there are people who are ready to go, coming out early and ready to go.
Yeah, I know Ben Simmons doesn't necessarily fit that exact description, having, you know, waited a year and then not had the greatest playoff run against the Cavaliers that he probably could have. But there are those guys that exist now. And a lot of people asking, you know, whether or not there's a top five that fits the Bulls, whether there's a guy that is a best fit. I don't know that at six, I don't know that six you're doing that. I think you're betting on upside at six, given what this draft class looks like. I think you're betting on upside.
Jackson or Bridges or somebody.
Or Porter, for that matter. I keep on coming back to that. And whether it's because he was your number one consensus guy going into a college season, whether it's because I hope that surgery works out just fine, I keep on coming back to doing something that's a little bit cute's probably not the right word, but it almost feels safe if you've got the medicals checked out. If you give him the big thumbs up and go, yeah, well, we'll try for this at six, he might have gone one otherwise if he was healthy.
Yeah, this draft was supposed to be the shot at the guy.
Yep.
And a couple things happened. I think the more we got to watch some of these players, the less we thought that any one of them was the guy. Because remember, before the season started, we're like, oh man, look at the top of this draft. Bagley and Porter and Doncic and Ayton. And the more I saw DeAndre Ayton, the more questions I have.
I think that's his turn. The game he had in the tournament was, I think, the thing that has taken the top off this draft more than anything else.
I watched him all year.
Oh, I know you did.
I watched him all year.
And even for those, you know, like myself who watched a little bit later on because we were doing a whole lot of baseball back in the day. I mean, this was you watched that performance. You saw that guy, and whether or not it was Sean Miller himself who was taking him out of plays or not getting the ball or putting him in the right places. I mean, that's a top overall profile that didn't get used in the right ways the last 3 weeks of that season.
So either way, you've got, on the one hand, the Bulls weren't bad enough to get one of those picks, as far as, you know, barring something special that happens tonight. They didn't give themselves enough of a chance at that happening. And on the other hand, maybe we just don't feel as strongly about one of those guys being at the top of this draft. And it's always the guy you know less about, which is why it seems Luka Doncic, because unless you've been watching a lot of these scouting videos of him, he is an unbelievable player.
You're a LeBron.
He's terrific.
I mean, that's
everything.
Guys who have played with him have put that label on him.
And that's in large part because that's the unknown. There was always that joke about, you know, if this guy named such and such from BYU, if he were over in Lithuania and his name were this, and extra syllables, he'd be a top five pick. Well, that's not really true anymore, because we know everybody, we see everybody.
Right.
You know, the mystery, the exotic nature of foreign basketball leagues, it really just isn't that anymore, because we can see all the games. You know, you got the Ball brothers over playing in Lithuania.
Doncic, though, is he's actually kind of the opposite. He's viewed as one of the more sure evaluations because he's been playing in the top league in Europe for so many years.
With men. Yeah
with men that right. People are essentially saying some of the reason he may not go number one over like Ayton is because he doesn't have that number one guy, because they know so much about him. They think he's essentially solid starter, may not ever be an all-star.
Yeah, much easier to scout him in a league where he was playing with Wolves. That was the problem with the EuroLeague for a long time. A lot of guys were playing against Wolves instead of men.
That was the league Giannis was in.
Right. Really difficult. Yeah, Darko Milicic was playing in that league, the Wolves League.
Yeah, it's true. And overall, the respect for EuroLeague basketball, the respect for the quality of basketball, the style of basketball, coupled with the internationalization of the NBA game, has in some ways, you're right, made it easier to scout guys who are playing against other professional players earlier on in their careers.
And for him specifically, it's just that he started at such a young age and had such a big role at such a young age. He wasn't like getting 5-6 minutes a game just sitting on the bench more often than not. He's been playing a good amount.
So the Bulls will be in a position to get somebody of value. I'm dubious as to whether or not this is going to be the best player on a champion arriving one way or another this year.
Yeah, I don't know that anybody's necessarily going to get that guy in this draft, or at least that's how a lot of the draft Knicks feel about this top tier coming into tonight's lottery.
Coming up next, we are going to talk to gaming and sports attorney expert Daniel Wallach, who was busy on Twitter yesterday talking about the ramifications of the POSPA repeal, and he'll have all the latest information for us and your chance, first of two chances, to win $1,000 in cash simply via a text. So keep it here. We are Bernstein and McKnight, and this is The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Oh, Steve Kerr, you're so silly.
I loved it.
Yeah, our guest actually had to postpone for an hour. Daniel Wallach is going to join us approximately an hour from now.
Okay, we'll move things around.
Had to move some things around, and that's okay. We'll do him right ahead of Joe Madden, who is going to join us at noon. Yeah, Kerr was walking right up to that line a little bit, and I guarantee you Adam Silver's like, Steve, don't make me.
Come on, man.
Yeah, come on. Don't make me do this. Man, for David Stern, for years, when I was joking before about the idea of everyone aghast at the idea that Michael Jordan was seen on a golf course with noted gambler and underworld figure Slim Buhler, and oh, they might be betting on golf. Oh no, he could be betting on golf, and what could that mean for the NBA? And how fearful David Stern was of any possible appearance of impropriety. He was terrified of gambling. Terrified of it.
Different then, right? I mean, it's not that David Stern didn't have a reason to be terrified of gambling. If you have an illegal activity that affects perhaps the outcome of your games, and again, if it was an illegal activity, then yeah, he was right to be worried about it. That said, now that we're in a world, and we'll talk to Daniel Wallach about it, like you mentioned, at 11:45, but once we're now living in a world where it is legal, that's not going to change how players themselves are or are not allowed to bet on their own games.
No, and the best...
It's not going to change that.
The best and disincentive you can give people is all that money. There's so much downside risk. There's so much money involved. And that's why the NCAA finds itself continually twisted in tighter and tighter knots. Because now that this is out there, now that there's this possibility that that's always been there, perhaps... And we have had point shaving scandals.
Yeah, St. John's,
Arizona State, where there was CCNY back in the day, Northwestern for football and basketball, mm-hmm. And it's all because of your BS amateurism model.
Yeah, in order for some of these elite players, whether it's Kevin Durant or LeBron, you'd have to bet like Floyd Mayweather in order to make it matter to you at all, right?
See, that's the other thing too. And I saw that Teddy Greenstein wrote something on this too. I thought in a very reasoned Tribune piece. Do you know how hard it is to consistently make money as a sports gambler?
Probably real hard.
You've got to hit on like 55%, and maybe even more now, depending on higher VIG and taxes.
Right.
Who could ever, if you look at even the supposed experts, the people who pick games in your newspaper,
lock of the week.
On your websites. Well, not even that. Not even the fake touts that are doing all that because they give half of people one and half
well,
the other.
Of course.
You saw the Real Sports Investigation.
Yeah, it did not go stuff. Well.
It didn't go well for anybody. But even somebody who says, look, this is something I do. If you're not a bookmaker, I understand how the house can make money. They've got the VIG.
Of course.
I get that.
They've got the chandeliers. Yeah, look at it.
Yes, the bookies make the money. If they're doing it properly around the margins and hedging big chunks, they're fine. But how can an amateur entertainment level sports gambler not presume you are going to lose? Or is part of it knowing you're going to lose? And this gets to the whole regressive tax and regressive industry. Eventually,
right.
You run out of people that... You just say, look, it's so much fun for me to have money at stake, or the rush that I get from winning so counterbalances the bad feelings I get from losing that it's okay. Like I genuinely do not get it. I don't have that gene. I don't understand it.
Right.
I don't get any extra joy or frisson from having something at stake. But you're going to lose.
Right. For me, I have gambled before. I've not gotten into sports gambling as much as a lot of other people have. But I do get the thrill of it. I understand it. I get that Jones for a little while. I've been known to sit down at a blackjack table for, I don't know, 8 or 9 hours. But that's in Vegas, where it's convenient and where I just, walk out the hotel or not even walk out. I just go down the elevator, turn right, and sit down at the blackjack table for $10 a hand for however long I want to. They'll bring you lunch, Dan. To me, we're talking about the growth of this industry, how much is actually there now, and how much money people would spend on sports betting later. The idea that states, entities, leagues, whatever, that there's so much money at stake here that they cannot, literally and metaphorically, afford to screw this up. I'm not convinced that one force will necessarily keep everybody on the up and up, but I am kind of convinced that the more convenient you make it, the you there being whatever league, entity, state legislature, whomever, the more convenient you make it, the more accessible that kind of little Jones is going to be. Those $3, $5 bets, those little things back and forth. Make it an app where you can set up a group of your friends, right? You get four or five people all there watching a game together, and now you start, it's the virtual gambling table, right? Where you've got your friends involved and parlay bets and all this kind of stuff. The more convenient you make it that way, the more you stand to fight off that feeling of, if I lose, I'm going to lose again. You know,
death by a thousand cuts. You're chasing in different ways.
Nobody cares if you're having fun, and that's that. We have the technology and the opportunity now to make it more fun than going to a sports book can seem.
Yeah, that's I guess the overall. If you're looking at it as an entertainment cost,
absolutely.
If you're going to pay $15 to go see the Avengers,
right.
What's the difference between making $3, $5 bets during the end of a baseball game? Right?
Very little. Very little.
Because there's no chance that you're going to win money on seeing the Avengers.
Well, no. Well, you could bet. No spoilers yet. No spoilers yet. I was going to say you could probably bet on some characters.
I think you're okay with the spoilers at this point. It is time for your chance to win $1,000 in cash on the score. This hour's keyword is bounce. Text bounce to 72881 by the end of the hour. Again, the keyword is bounce to 72881. One randomly selected nationwide entrant from this hour will win. Please do not text and drive. Message and data rates may apply. And this segment brought to you by Fogo de Chão. Celebrate dad, your grad, or those closest to you with the fresh flavors of weekend Brazilian brunch now at Fogo de Chão in Chicago, Rosemont, and Naperville. This is the Bernstein and McKnight Show. If you're just joining us, say, who are these guys? Well, we are on from 9 to 1. We are the Scores Midday Show. And if you have a thought for us, you're always welcome. 312-644-6767.
You know, coming back from break, we heard Steve Kerr talking about the change to the sports landscape and now PASPA being shut down and the federal government changing their stance on whether gambling should be run by the states or completely disallowed. I couldn't help but think, and we talked about this early on in the show during the propers, the idea that the Warriors have now completely obfuscated the Rockets. That after one game, and it's not people watching, you know, a bunch of games during the season. It's some of the biggest talking heads in that industry. Barkley, Shaq, the whole thing. Three-game series, you know, all that kind of hyperbole. I'm not altogether convinced. Although the way the Warriors won was exactly how everyone figured they would. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. if the Warriors are to beat the Rockets, then this, that, and the other has to happen. All of those this, that, and the others happened last night. I don't know that I'm still convinced that the Rockets don't work. We were talking a little while ago about a guy I went to high school with, Chris DeMarco.
Mm-hmm.
He
took your spot.
He did.
He usurped your position on the basketball team.
He took my spot on the JV basketball team by being ridiculously, ludicrously better than I was.
Why wasn't he on the varsity basketball team?
He was a freshman.
Oh.
So yeah.
Were they ineligible? Or
no, they weren't ineligible. Coach Robbins had a thing. I think DeMarco, by the end of the year, ended up playing varsity ball. But he started on the JV team as a freshman. I got my ass cut. DeMarco ends up playing on the varsity team his freshman year. And that I think that ended up being my senior year, which would have been DeMarco's junior, one of the best basketball teams they had in a real long time up there. I mean, he was a damn good player. Either way, this DeMarco guy is the dude who's in charge of scouting the Rockets for the Warriors. And I was reading a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle that kind of profiled DeMarco's work and how they scout the Rockets. He's got four different teams. I don't remember what the other three are, but the Rockets are one of them. And he pointed out in this piece that you watch the Rockets and it seems as though what they're doing with their ISOs, the fact that James Harden is just pounding the rock into the floor seven or eight times and then getting into an offense, they're actually better, this Warriors scout and assistant coach pointed out, they're actually better at getting the matchups out of those ISOs than it looks. They're actually better at finding spots, finding the matchups for Paul and for Harden than it seems. And what the Warriors, I thought, did last night was make sure that, yeah, at times you're going to have some switches not play out the right way, but they, both those teams, switch everything. And they've got players who can manage one side or the other. And unless, you know, we saw Steph Curry get, I thought, a little gimpy in the third quarter.
He didn't look good.
Yeah, had a whole thing. He was grabbing at his knee. He made it look like he went to his knees down in the block, guarding Harden for a minute, I think. He's going for his knee and kind of like feeling around, like, okay, everything's fine, and then starts adjusting the tights and the pad he's got down there to make it, I thought, make it look like, oh, I'm just, you know, futzing with my stuff and got my gear. I got to change around a little bit. If that's an issue, then it becomes something completely different.
Or you could argue the opposite and say, if they can win a game going away without Curry being at the peak of his powers, what does that say?
Well, it says that Kevin Durant hit everything.
Right, but Zach Harper was just telling us that that's the guy that changes the geometry of the game more than anybody else. That's the guy who can single-handedly,
yeah,
who can destroy you. And if he's not ordinary, but if he's just fine, if he's not superhuman and you are still clearly the better team, that's why the guys you're talking about, that's why Barkley, that's why the experts are saying some of the things they're saying.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely part of the point there.
And the matchups, to me, the defensive matchups, too, that mattered yesterday weren't so much in the half court as much as they were in secondary break and off of made basket and while guys are running the floor. Get on somebody. The decisions they made regarding Klay Thompson were consistently bad when it mattered most.
No doubt about it.
And the communication was wrong, and there's just too much space allowed. Find somebody. If you need to fix it, there will be enough screens set that you'll be able to fix it in some of these switches, or it's going to take care of itself anyway. But just man up at that point. Make sure that there's a guy on every other guy, because they're not going to wait. They're not going to sit around and say, is this the shot I should be taking? Because the green light's going. It's Klay Thompson.
Only two Rockets players other than Paul and Harden were in double figures last night. Eric Gordon had 15 and Clint Capella had 12. You and I both talked about Capella and how he kind of fit the, not exactly, but that Amari Stoudemire kind of thing in D'Antoni's offense, right? Kind of fit that mold, I guess, or the updated mold that it's got. I'm wondering why he's not around in that offense more often. And if that's, you know, maybe we'll see in game two, but if that's how the Warriors are deciding to allow some of those switches to go defensively, if they're starting to allow, all right, fine. If Harden's got to score 50, okay, we'll make sure that that's it.
Yeah, D'Antoni was joking with Harden. He's like, hey, you know, next time you got to score 50. He kind of does.
Damn right you do.
If it's going to look like that, and there's going to be times where Clint Capella could stand there with a cup of coffee in both hands and not really matter, that's your recipe.
And there were possessions, too, some pick and rolls up there where you saw him, Capella, do what he'd been doing. You saw that kind of that roll to the rim, that finish, too. He had a couple of pickups that I think he was able to throw down for a point or two. That's the guy. I mean, he's got matchup ability. He's got an ability to create problems for them. But they seem to, through a couple of switches up at the top, to kind of isolate him and move him away from everything else.
The thing is, they didn't turn the Warriors over. The Warriors have a lot of turnovers. That's how teams that beat them make them careless and take advantage of that. So it's kind of, even though they want to slow the pace down, being selectively aggressive, that's where a lot of their other guys start to get involved. They only turned him over 9 times all game.
We have the 13.
The midday midway coming up next. I have a baseball police action.
Oh, God.
A former White Sox. And when I tell you who it was and where it happened, you're going to say, of course this guy has self-deputized. And he was in a position to do so.
We've got an incoming NFL rookie who had himself maybe too good of a time at a different sporting event, and a story that we're going to have to, the FCC might be looking into some of the language on this next story. We got to find some creative ways to talk about some bodily functions in this next one.
I know where you're headed with that. I also want to praise an airline for a decision they made. It's been an ongoing theme.
Really?
Of discussion regarding some policy. And it's all headed in the right direction, I believe. That's coming up in the midday midway on The Score.